Hello, I'm Rob, and this is the Right Podcast, where I examine the far right in the US and abroad, populist movements and credit politics, and critique the left from a leftist perspective. And this episode's going to be a little different. It'll still talk about politics, but in a different approach. Plus, some of the previous episodes were getting to be a bit philosophical, and you probably already have a lot on your mind with the holidays and such. Around this time last year, I broke a bit from my previous topics to write an article, albeit still political, about the Twilight Zone Marathon. For those of you who don't know, the Twilight Zone was a television series created and hosted by Rod Serling that aired from 1959 to 1964 using science fiction and speculative storytelling to explore many different topics from fear, power, conformity, responsibility, ethics, morals, etc. Some were very serious while others were lighthearted. After its initial run on TV, it faded into the background as another old sci-fi style show, along with others like The Outer Limits, something closer to the original Star Trek than philosophy or politics. Cable news stations would air reruns, but the resurgence really came many years later in the form of the Twilight Zone Marathon. The first Twilight Zone Marathon reportedly aired on Thanksgiving in 1980, before eventually landing on New Year's Eve. But for me, it was originally a 4th of July ritual, and I have no idea what channel it was that I would watch it on. But while other kids were outside in the heat, I was glued to the television. The marathon would run all day, sometimes into the next, with one episode titled The Masks from season 5, episode 25 in 1964, becoming the specially placed segment bridging the gap between years at midnight. It's the episode where wealthy, cruel relatives are forced to wear these grotesque masks at a Mardi Gras style party. And unbeknownst to them, the masks slowly fuse to their faces. And when they finally remove them at midnight, their real faces have permanently taken on the shape of the masks, revealing their worst personal qualities, such as greed. The Twilight Zone Marathon became a New Year's Eve tradition in the US during a time when television still functioned as a shared experience, and in this case, a civic space. Streaming didn't really exist yet, and the marathon became something of an event, prompting a resurgence in popularity. There's something important about that because many of the episodes had political, ethical, and moral themes that would not have normally come up at a lighthearted Christmas party. People watched the same stories at the same time. They might have argued about them, but they absorbed moral questions together, even when they disagreed about the answers. And that's something that matters. Shared cultural rituals once worked as informal civic education. They didn't tell people what to think, but they gave them a common language for thinking at all. As those rituals have fractured, as media becomes more individualized, people can more easily ignore these uncomfortable narratives wrapped up in entertainment and shared ritual or reference points. In other words, algorithms form echo chambers. When the marathon arrived each year, it felt like a marker. Cold weather, dark rooms, television running for hours with these unsettling black and white stories. For fans of Rod Serling, it wasn't just nostalgia, though. It was a return to questions that refused to disappear. I encountered Twilight Zone through my mother. The first time I heard Ron Serling's voice, I was in my childhood living room, sitting next to my mom, and she would joke about the sometimes comical special effects and how things like giant spiders or ridiculous alien creatures used to scare her as a little girl. But she'd also talk about the meaning of each episode. It wasn't a lecture, but was done with purpose. Serling used science fiction to address politics, racism, greed, groupthink, and other subjects that were risky to tackle directly during the show's run. My mother watched the show during its original broadcast and carried its warnings into adulthood. And that approach mattered. Serling never treated ethics as something learned through rules. He treated it as something learned through story. His episodes don't demand agreements. They're not overtly political. They create recognition. People resist being told what to do and what to believe, but they're often open or willing to recognize themselves when it comes to narrative. By the time I was 13 or 14, I was recording the marathons on VHS. Some of the classics, Time Enough at Last, Eye of the Beholder, but especially one called The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street. And at the time, they felt like artifacts. You know, these are these old black and white messages from a past America that had already solved the problems Serling warned about. I assumed the ethical and political issues presented in those monologues were anchored to the fictional plot points or the historical events portrayed in each episode. And that illusion stayed for a while. My mom also made sure I watched other things. I remember watching Nelson Mandela walk free from prison, or, you know, documentaries about Steve Biko with apartheid South Africa, civil rights movement. But all of it felt like history was a moral arc. It was just so easy to believe as a child that the world was moving in the right direction, or at least in some direction at all. And it took years to realize what these stories were really doing, because they weren't documenting events or plot points. They were mapping recurring patterns in people. Last year, I wrote about The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street. This conversation builds on that piece and pairs it with another episode, Color Me Black. It's what my latest article is about. They share the same concern, even though they focus on different moments in the process. So Maple Street shows how fear forms, the role of the scapegoat and how that can turn violent. Well, Color Me Black shows what happens when that fear spreads. And together, they aren't warnings about monsters or black and white hubcap UFOs, even though those are really super cool. They're warnings about what happens when people seek certainty, ignoring fallibility in the process. That first episode, The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street, I even use this as an adjunct professor in a political science class. It's excellent. It starts out in a quiet suburban street. So the neighbors are all out. They're familiar with each other. It's very 1950s. And then there's a sudden disruption. Something flies through the sky, but you don't see it as a viewer. You see the characters look up. And when it does that, the lights kind of flicker on and off. And no one knows why. And so all the neighbors get together and they start talking about, was that an asteroid? Or was that a comet?
Maybe some kind of an electrical storm or something.
Now that don't seem likely. Sky's just as blue as anything. Not a cloud, no lightning, no thunder, no nothing. How could it be a storm?
Can't get a thing on the radio, not even on the portable.
Why don't we go downtown and check with the police? They'll probably think we're crazy or something. A little power failure and everybody gets flustered and everything.
It isn't just a power failure, Charlie. If it were, we'd still be able to get a broadcast on the portable. I'll take a run downtown. Maybe I can get it straightened out.
Yeah.
What Serling shows us is not chaos right away, but something more believable, right? He shows us the moment that uncertainty or fear begins to reorganize how people think. Fear doesn't just make people angry and all of a sudden you have a KKK robe on, right? It collapses tolerance for uncertainty. So psychologically, the human mind would rather accept a wrong explanation than sit with nuance or shades of gray. Anxiety creates the illusion that decisiveness equals truth. Acting feels safer than waiting, discussing, or thinking things through. Accusations can even feel safer than that doubt. And once that fear sets in, people stop asking what is true and start asking, maybe not consciously, what will make this bad feeling stop? What makes that feeling stop becomes truth regardless of facts. It's how we rationalize what is really a way to end the unease we're experiencing, whether the cause of that unease is real or not. And that's why conspiracy thinking is so effective. And there's conspiracy in this episode. about what happened, right? Who's causing all this? Instead of engaging in complications, or the reality that these might just be coincidences, right? This could be a group panic situation. But regardless, there could be nuance and shades of gray and complications that weren't maybe not even aware of. We identify an antagonist, the one pulling the strings, right? A central force and its supposed agents who then become our scapegoats, right? The people that are perpetrating this plan. And this is great because what we're doing is really, we're creating a story ourselves, kind of like what Serling did in the Twilight Zone, except, you know, in these stories, what we're doing is we're making ourselves the protagonist. And that's wonderful because then we get to be the hero, right? We're the ones that has to overcome everything and succeed in the end. For instance, you know, along those lines, in some white nationalist perspectives, Jewish people, of course, control the world, global events, and use minorities or refugees to enact their plots. Politically, this is where populism enters, because once fear collapses people's tolerance for uncertainty, then certainty begins to look like leadership, regardless of what form it takes. The person who speaks without hesitation sounds strong. The person who pauses to ask for evidence sounds fickle or weak. Action is framed as decisiveness, while nuance is dismissed. Doubt can become recoded in this situation as a form of disloyalty, while hesitation or protest against what's happening can become a complicity. To construct the scapegoat, a psychological inversion takes place. Those actively supporting or driving the process begin to see themselves as the victim. Harm is no longer something they do, but something done to them. I mean, this is why Hitler called his book Mein Kampf, right? My struggle. Yeah, it's his struggle, not, you know, people in the concentration camps. The violence is framed as response, not initiation. This inversion allows or also absolves the perpetrators of responsibility. No matter how inhumane their actions become in this warped logic, this rationalization, the scapegoat is said to have caused the violence inflicted upon them. And cruelty becomes a necessity. If only they had followed the rules, if only they had behaved differently, if only they had done this or that, if only they had integrated. These conditions never end, because it's not about the behavior or the conditions that are being set. The victim is accused of failing an invisible, impossible test, one that shifts whenever compliance appears possible, such as showing up to an immigration office, for instance. The conditions are never met because that's not their purpose. In fact, they would fail if they were met. They aren't necessarily laws to be followed, but instead, they're justification for the persecution that's happening. And this is how violence presents itself as moral. The perpetrators, they don't see themselves as choosing violence. They're the ones responding to provocation. They're the ones defending themselves, even as they enact violence upon others. And once that inversion settles in, criticism itself becomes intolerable. And so this is how, you know, anti-racists become the real racist. This is how human rights groups become part of the establishment's conspiracy. Anything that reintroduces uncertainty threatens the sense of certainty now required to hold that story together. And if you point out abuses against the scapegoat, then you're with the scapegoat or an agent of the broader conspiracy of the establishment. Consciously or not, what's happening is people are constructing a worldview that must be infallible. It has to be 100% to feel stable. But demanding infallibility is itself fallacious. It's a fallacy because no human framework survives without error, revision, or the possibility of negative testing. In other words, if something can't be shown to be wrong, then it can't also be shown to be right either. So there's a series, almost like a guide that you can go through of fear and uncertainty, disruption collapses tolerance for ambiguity. Certainty as relief, decisiveness becomes truth, and nuance becomes weakness. Agency compression, right? Complex causes are collapsed into a single antagonist or easy answers. The construction of the scapegoat, a target is identified to carry the anxiety. Psychological inversion happens. The perpetrators reframe themselves as the victims, and violence becomes a response, not an initiation. There's moralization of harm. Cruelty becomes necessity. Responsibility dissolves. The unfalsifiable certainty. Imperfection is treated as disproof, right? Fallibility becomes illegitimacy. Closure and reinforcement. Criticism becomes betrayal, and dissent is recoded as threat. And really, that's what all of this is. It's a threat response, whether that threat is real or imagined. And this is the collapse of epistemic humility. The understanding that I might be wrong is replaced with moral certainty. And once the possibility of error disappears, accountability also goes with it. And that's what happened in the Maple Street episode. One of the most arresting moments comes when the character Les Goodman breaks from the Maple Street crowd, who are seeking a scapegoat to blame for the flashing lights and cars that are starting on their own. As the neighborhood grows frantic, it's the early stages of a mob forming, searching for someone to blame. Goodman knows what's happening before it fully begins, and he speaks. And he isn't speaking with hindsight; he's speaking with foresight. He understands that fear is no longer responding to events, but is creating and leading them. In that creation or manifestation is both validation and social reward for the mob that's forming. But of course, no one listens.
You scared, frightened rabbits, you. You're sick people, do you know that? You're sick people, all of you. And you don't even know what you're starting here, because let me tell you, you're starting something here that's what you should be frightened of. As God is my witness, you're letting something begin here that's a nightmare.
And so in the first article, I apply this to politics, and I apply it to the first Trump administration entering into the second Trump administration. But you can't just start there. And, you know, studying history, there's a lot of places you can go. You can go really far back if you want. But where I think I start is the optimism of the 1990s. And perhaps it's because I was a teenager then or very young. I don't know. I'm kind of in between. But the optimism of the 1990s gave many people a sense that history was bent in a way, or that arc, right, in the right direction, like I mentioned earlier, but a little bit different. It wasn't just the idea that, you know, we no longer have separate but equal and Jim Crow because humans are becoming better. That's kind of what I was thinking as a child. This was more like human. This is more of like a Francis Fukuyama sense, right, of the end of history, right? Because the Cold War ended, the Berlin Wall fell, third way politics in the United States with new Democrats formed, the economy was growing, the internet was promising new technology, openness and connection like never before, access to information like never before, liberal democracy was declared victorious. But, you know, underneath all of this, there was strain and fractures building, along with a lot of kind of whitewashing of those fractures that had previously existed too. And economic inequality widened. Structural issues like racism and gender injustice were exposed rather than resolved. Neoliberal globalization delivered efficiencies, you could argue, but certainly not dignity and not necessarily a better quality or standard of life for everybody. And institutions explained outcomes while failing to provide stability. This is the age of, or the beginnings of global austerity. And there's a lot of history here. There's too much for this episode. But after the collapse of the Soviet Union, worldviews fundamentally changed for many people. And in the Maple Street article, I started out with the Tea Party era critique because that led directly to the rise of MAGA. But you know, it could be, again, multiple episodes, even a full podcast, given the amount of content there. What's most important for this discussion is that conspiracy thinking offers coherence and that this was an era that seemed to lack it for many. It transforms uncertainty into explanation and it converts fear into moral certainty. And that's why the conspiracies, like him or not, doesn't really matter, but the conspiracies surrounding Barack Obama's presidency weren't just random. Contradictory accusations were collapsing on a single caricature, making him almost kind of like a superhero in a weird way. He was all at once a communist, fascist, Islamist, Manchurian candidate, all these different things. But the content didn't really matter. And that's the point, right? It's the rise of conspiracy and the fact that it was incoherent. The content didn't matter. The certitude that his presidency was invalid to those who could not reconcile its reality is what mattered. Right, that certainty. And this is important to say because it's the beginning of the post-truth era, and it matters because it's when Donald Trump entered the picture. Right, Trump didn't invent this collapse of shared reality. He identified how far it already eroded, and he exploited it. You know, and he exploited it with birtherism. You know, birtherism wasn't persuasive because of its evidence. It worked because it offered certainty to people already primed to distrust institutions and resent shades of gray. It reconciled the unease some felt, similar to what happened in that Maple Street episode. And in that environment, evidence no longer operates the same, right? It's not something that could be correct or interrupt a belief, right? Claims gained force through repetition rather than verification. While institutions were dismissed as corrupt or biased the moment they complicated the story being told, they could be embraced as authoritative when they seemed to confirm it. Truth, in other words, became conditional on loyalty rather than correspondence with reality. And January 6th was not a spontaneous breakout or some unfortunate anomaly. It followed directly from a worldview that no longer allowed for error, because when a leader cannot be wrong, then losing becomes impossible. It breaks that fallacious worldview that had been formed. And when losing is impossible, then opponents who win are no longer rivals, but usurpers. And again, that inversion occurs, right? The usurper becomes the one being usurped. And when opponents are framed as illegitimate, force begins to appear not only as justified, but necessary. And the monsters are due on Maple Street. The aliens do turn out to be real. But that reveal is almost not relevant. The neighborhood has already destroyed itself by the time it arrives. And the collapse doesn't come from an external enemy or a UFO, as explained in one of the best epilogues in the Twilight Zone series.
The tools of conquest do not necessarily come with bombs and explosions and fallout. There are weapons that are simply thoughts, attitudes, prejudices, to be found only in the minds of men. For the record, prejudices can kill, and suspicion can destroy. And a thoughtless, frightened search for a scapegoat has a fallout all of its own. For the children and the children yet unborn. And the pity of it is that these things cannot be confined to the Twilight Zone.
In the real world, there is no moment where the truth finally arrives, right? The curtains don't come up and everything snaps back into place, even though that's the premise of a lot of ways of thinking, religious apocalyptic thinking or fascist rebirth myths. The episode and focus of my last article, the full title being I Am the Night, Color Me Black, that was the episode, begins precisely at that point. It asks what happens after fear is no longer reactive, right? After suspicion becomes the norm and after darkness stops feeling like crisis and begins to spread. It's no longer an isolated incident. In the Twilight Zone episode, Color Me Black, a small town is consumed by a veil of darkness. Sheriff Charlie Koch rises on the morning of a scheduled execution and finds that the sun didn't rise that morning. And the town is reacting with fear and confusion over the events. Amid that panic, a newspaper man named Colby begins to question whether the person about to be executed is really guilty or not. And in the hours before the execution, the sheriff begins to carry a growing sense of guilt because he knows the investigation had been compromised by political pressure and by public demand to find the person guilty. Later, on the day of the hanging, Reverend Anderson addresses the crowd at the gallows. He calls for mercy and warns them not to answer hatred with hatred. The warning, of course, is ignored, and the execution goes forward in what would have been full daylight, but under a darkness the town had already created. Afterward, Anderson told the town that the darkness around them was a reflection of their own actions.
Do you know why it's dark? Do you know why there's night all around us? Do you know what the blackness is? It's the hate he felt, the hate you felt, the hate all of us feel, and it's too much of it. It's just too much. And so we had to vomit it out. And now it's coming up all around us and choking us. So much hate, so much miserable hate.
Look. Look what's happening. It's getting even darker now. I can't hardly see anything now.
Later, a radio report announces that other towns are also experiencing this darkness, and it's going worldwide. Hatred, Serling tells us, is a sickness found everywhere, including in the mirror. And, you know, that matters. For Serling, the danger was never the event itself, but the moral atmosphere surrounding it, right? The darkness emerged from human decisions, not from external or atmospheric causes or scapegoats or anything else, but from the people themselves. And this is where Color Me Black stops functioning as an allegory and starts functioning as a diagnosis, because the darkness that spreads today has the same psychological and political mechanisms that keep getting reused. So, you know, I focused a lot on Trump in that first article, but this is spreading across Europe. Far-right and authoritarian movements draw from an almost identical emotional script. Marine Le Pen in France frames decline as cultural betrayal. Giorgia Meloni in Italy casts exclusion as national recovery. The Gauwaiders in Netherlands and Viktor Orbán in Hungary present liberal democracy as not legitimate, not because it failed procedurally, but because in a conspiracy it's been captured by scapegoats, migrants, NGOs, journalists, LGBTQ advocates. And these are all framed as, you know, foreign-backed elites. Elections occur, but pluralism is treated as an enemy or sabotage. The AfD in Germany draws openly on white nationalist frameworks, framing demographic change as an existential threat and recoding equal rights as cultural erasure. Its grievances explain social anxiety not through policy failure, not through economics, not through material conditions, but through the presence of racialized outsiders and those accused of protecting them. And it just so happens Elon Musk and our vice president is cozy with them. Our political legitimacy comes from the identification of enemies, not from actually governing. So the histories are different in all these places, but the structure and the mechanism is not. In all cases, power is justified by naming enemies and presenting exclusion as self-defense. Institutions that protect pluralism are recast as accomplices while dissent becomes betrayal. And it's not just Europe. I mean, we just saw recent elections in Chile, for instance. And this is Maple Street without fences, right? The spreading darkness. What Reverend Anderson described in Color Me Black is no longer confined to one town or one nation. The darkness moves outward, and it's carried not by storms or enemies, but by the actions of people and the way that they think. In the real world, this same fear is leveraged by those in the pursuit of power. The same fears repeat across borders, the same resentments resurface in different languages. And it's not a, you know, conspiracy in some hypocritical way that I'm making up either. I mean, just recently a leaked national security strategy draft proposed pulling Italy, Austria, Poland, and Hungary from the EU to form some type of populist group internationally. So, you know, that's Maple Street at a global scale. But, you know, a lot of that was about the far right, and I talk a lot about the far right, but, you know, it's why Gaza and Ukraine matter here, and of course all other conflicts throughout. But Gaza and Ukraine are interesting because both demand that we recognize human suffering before ideology. I'm going to say that again. Both Gaza and Ukraine demand that we recognize human suffering before ideology, as darkness spreads when that empathy becomes conditional based on it. That lesson transcends far right and applies across the political spectrum, including segments of the left too. But much of the underlying issue or issues causing this general global malaise can be addressed, right? We can sit there and talk about it and think about it and find the structural, the economic, the legal, the political, but that would involve challenging power, right? And people blaming scapegoats for their problems doesn't do that. Once scapegoats are in place, nationalism, you know, gives them permanence, right? Refugees stop being people responding to war or poverty, and they become symbols of invasion or some other grievance. Human rights are again reframed as protection of those scapegoats. The nation is imagined as something under constant siege, and disagreement is treated as sabotage rather than dissent. It's something that maybe someone who's Rod Serling adjacent, Orwell, yes, the 1984 Orwell touches on in his piece Notes on Nationalism. And this is where walls appear, not first as policy, but as symbols, right? History is full of walls. I have an undergrad degree in history. There's lots of walls everywhere. Walls that outlive the societies that built them, castles, fortresses, etc., right? They remain long after the fear that justified them has shifted or disappeared. Walls promise insulation from the world, from complexity, from uncertainty itself. They suggest that if the boundary is strong enough, nothing unsettling can cross it. But walls don't preserve societies. They create artifacts. What collapses behind them isn't caused by the threat outside, but within. And Serling understood this. The danger is never from outside the gate in his stories. It is what fear did to the people inside the gate. And that is the so-called enemy within. If Rod Serling were alive today, he would not begin talking about these things with policy or ideology or politics. He would begin where he always did, with the human condition. And he might say something like this, and this is my best Rod Serling epilogue attempt, which I'm quite proud of. Presented for your consideration, a group of frightened, resentful people. They could live in any town, any city, or in any country. They scan the horizon for an enemy they insist is imminent. What they fail to see is that the enemy they fear has already arrived. That enemy is the fear and resentment that brought them to this point in the first place. Watching The Twilight Zone with my children feels fundamentally different from watching it when I was young with my mother. And, you know, when I was younger, those episodes, again, felt like artifacts, warnings that had already done their work. They serve no new purpose, really. Now they feel immediate in a way that is difficult to ignore. They don't sit at the historical distance anymore. And trying to help my kids make sense of the world without letting that pressure turn into despair feels like part of what these stories quietly require, not because they offer answers, but because they insist on a kind of ongoing engagement with how people respond to fear. And this is where cynicism becomes its own form of darkness. You know, we've talked a lot about what other people do. Well, you know, cynicism is something that we all might engage in. And cynicism disguises itself as realism, right? It asks only for distance and disengagement. And once that happens, change feels pointless. And responsibility can be easy to avoid, especially if you're not directly engaged in the persecution or the war or the conflict. In Serling's world, that is exactly how the darkness spreads. It does not grow through a dramatic act of hatred, right? It grows through the choices, like no longer believing that our words and actions matter. The darkness doesn't begin with cartoon-like villains, but with ordinary people responding to real or imagined threats. When the future becomes uncertain, insecurity takes hold. And even if we can't avoid that feeling of being insecure, we can certainly be responsible for how we react to it. Some turn to conspiracies or scapegoats for easy but dangerous answers. We see that happening everywhere. Others choose a different path, a harder, albeit more complicated path, but one that recognizes the equal worth of every life and the necessity of cooperation. Kind of like dignity, it needs to be recognized. If people sense their place in the world narrowing, humiliation can follow, and some attempt to reclaim dignity by pushing others aside, but that only spreads indignity to both the target and the perpetrator. They can make themselves appear to be heroes all they want, but in reality, that's not what happens, right? Dignity does not survive without people examining their assumptions and accepting that it must be shared to exist at all. If these emotions go unexamined, people become symbols and they lose their humanity. Once people are no longer recognized as equal beings and are treated as symbols instead, any offense against them can be justified. The alternative is to accept the reality, that our futures are tied together. There's no debate, no social media post, no rhetorical or physical wall that can change that reality. If we cannot see ourselves in others, then our vision has become so clouded that we cannot see ourselves at all. This option doesn't ignore the underlying causes of anxiety or grievance. As a matter of fact, it moves all this other junk out of the way so that those can be focused on. Right? It answers them with productive solidarity rather than self-destructive fear. And I think, as an adult, about the choices characters in these Twilight Zone episodes made, and the small acts, such as just expressing humility or listening, might have prevented the ensuing chaos. And they're not grand gestures. You know, it's not a heroic thing with a big explosion in the background and some guy dodging bullets and super speed, right? They're just common daily acts that keep a neighborhood, a country, or a generation from slipping into Maple Street like logic and spreading darkness. And thinking through these choices and retelling these stories is the responsibility Serling placed on his audience. Sharing this article with someone who believes these lessons belong to the past or with someone encountering them for the first time is something that we can all do, right? Because Serling did his part. Rod Serling did what he could do. And now the responsibility to keep teaching these lessons rests with us. And, you know, maybe these articles will become a tradition like the Twilight Zone Marathon itself. You know, it's 2 years in a row now, so it's a pattern. Anyway, have a good holiday, however you practice it, if you do it all. And thanks for listening.
What you're about to see is a series called The Twilight Zone.
2 days, 46 hours.
Time enough at last.
With your favorite episodes. Uncut in prime time with never-before-seen footage.
Stop it, Willoughby.
It's a cookbook.
And a special sneak preview.
This is the Twilight Zone.
From the Twilight Zone Definitive Edition DVD box set. It's a Twilight Zone marathon. Starts Friday, December 31st on Sci-Fi.